Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 174. Welcome back, everyone. I hope you've all been enjoying the recent run. By Jove, it's been strong with a great chat with Russell Howard last week, Michael Fassbender the week before. And this week we're continuing that run as I'm joined by Armando Iannucci, the legend Armando Iannucci. Before we get into this, I want to tell you a few things. If this is your first time tuning in, then you might want to browse our back catalogue for people like Stuart Lee and Richard Herring and Adam Buxton, Paddy Considine, who's in the film that we're here to primarily talk about. Obviously, we get into a lot of stuff, but that film is The Death of Stalin. So you might want to, yeah, as I said, browse back and see Paddy and Simon Pegg, maybe Nick Frost, John Ronson. I'm just throwing out people that you might fancy having to listen to. There's been some good ones, I promise you. Also, this is the film The Death of Stalin is based on a graphic novel of the same name, which I recommend you check out. But also, I've had a lot of I know I've got a lot of listeners who are into graphic novels. I've had previous guests of Alan Moore and Garth Ennis and Warren Ellis and Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey, tons of good people. But I want to recommend a comic I've read recently, or a graphic novel I've read recently, called God's Country. It's really good. It's by a guy called Donnie Cates, and I bought it. I chatted to Donnie a little bit on Twitter over the years, and I'd caught a few bits of his work and thought they were cool. And then I was in a shop the other day and saw, you know, a highly recommended new book, and I saw his name on it. I thought, I know that guy, I'll check that out. And then I bought it, and it's absolutely amazing. So, yeah. I should also mention that we are brought to you, as ever, by SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. That is my record label. It is also where you can buy Distraction Pieces podcast merch. You can buy CDs, vinyl. A CD is it's an old format. You might not be familiar with. CD stands for car disc, because they're discs that we listen to primarily in cars, and they have music on them. So we sell CDs and vinyl and loads of other good stuff. So check them out. SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. We've just launched our umbrellas, our rucksacks, our scarves, our sweaters, our bobble hats, all our winter range. So check them out. But I'm going to let you get into this episode now, because it's a lovely chat with Armando. I went to a screening of Death of Stalin, and I sat next to a guy. Like, there was a lot of YouTubers and podcasters and reviewers there, and I sat next to a guy, and I said, it's always awkward when you've booked a podcast before you've seen the film that the podcast is going to be primarily about. And we were chatting, and I was saying it's always paid off well with Garth Jennings and numerous other people, but it's always a risk. And then just before it started, he said, well, you know, I'm a fan of your work, so I really hope you enjoy it. And that's when he revealed he's one of the writers. And I'd been sitting there going, oh, I hope it's good. So that was awkward, but enjoyable, because turns out it's absolutely fantastic. So far, it's made its way as a late entrant into my Films of the Year list. For anyone who follows me on social media, at Scroobius Pipio on Instagram and Twitter, and just Scroobius Pip on Facebook, you'll know each year I do my Films of the Year. So this year, I've been the most organised on it. It's every time I've gone to see a film, I've put it onto a list of all the films I've seen this year. And I've seen a lot of films in the cinema this year. I'm on 30 or 40 so far, or more than that, maybe. But, Death of Stalin has snuck into my list. It's fantastic. We talk about it a lot in the podcast, so I won't go into it in huge detail now, but I recommend you check it out. As you're listening to this, it is out now. It came out on Friday. So go and see it. You will enjoy it. It's very funny. And the cast is just ridiculous. And obviously it's Armando. Armando doesn't do bad things. before we get into Armando, actually, I'll mention that next week's guest is a great one. It's S. Craig Zahler, who's the writer and director of Bone Tomahawk, one of my films of 2016 or 15. It was either end of 15 or beginning of 16. And Brawl in Cell Block 99, which is, again, another one that has made it into my films of the year. It's probably out now. It might even be on demand now. It stars Vince Vaughn, and it's absolutely amazing. It's really good. He's being hyped a lot as kind of a new Tarantino. I think that's kind of lazy, because I don't think his style is very Tarantino, but I get what they mean in that you watch one of his films and you recognise it as an S. Craig Zahler film. So he'll be next week's guest. So this is episode 174 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Armando Iannucci. So I'm rolling. It might not have picked up, but as we started recording, there was a drum machine playing on my on my mixing desk there.
So well, I insist unusual. On that.
Yeah, yeah, that's how you like to start most podcasts.
It's my
right?
intro. Well, not just podcasts, just anywhere in life. You know, if I walk into a shop, you know, we ring ahead so that they can have a drum machine playing as I come in.
It's important to have an impact and have that introduction into a room. I'm joined by Armando Iannucci. How are you today, sir?
I'm very good, actually. I'm doing quite well. I did a whole day yesterday from 8 a.m. till about 8 p.m. of talking.
Oh, wow.
About the film.
And how was that? Are you tired of it yet?
I'm not tired. I'm getting tired of the film. I've seen it so many times
that
I can't now sit. We're doing the premiere tonight, so obviously I'll sit through that, and then and then I'll put watching the film to bed for a number of years.
I saw it on Friday, and you got to rush off gracefully, and I sat next to Peter, who's obviously watched it a few times as well, and at the end I was like, how was that watching it with a crowd? He's like, I've seen it a lot. It's quite honestly, I was like, that was amazing. He's like, I've seen it a lot.
And I know.
I'm now noticing every time there is a laugh or isn't a laugh.
I know, but also you start thinking of stuff you took out, or maybe I could have put a line back in there, or maybe the laugh would have been even bigger if we'd shaved a few frames. You know, it's all that stuff, which would just drive you mad. So you have to actually stop. I mean, obviously you hand the film over when you're happy with it, and I'm happy with it.
Yeah,
but,
of course.
You know, if you keep looking at it, you'll just get driven mad.
Yeah. Right? How quick a turnover was this project? Because it feels like, I don't know, it felt that the excitement still felt quite fresh with everyone. And that's often, when there's a long edit and a long turnover, you're kind of onto the next project and you've forgotten about the
excitement.
It's been
a very happy and fast process.
Yeah, it felt like that.
You know, I was asked to do the story based on the graphic novel.
You should mention The Death of Stalin is your new film.
Oh, yes,
let's
of course.
Let's get the name in there as well. Let's mention.
You can see I've having topped myself raw, I'm now completely rubbish at promoting my own movie.
definitely.
There was a point yesterday when I was doing a radio interview, and they sat me down, and just before the interview they said, now we're going to do two things. We're going to do the actual programme itself, and you'll be joined by a number of other guests who are going to be talking about A, B and C, and then separately I'd like to take you away, and we're going to do a separate thing for a podcast, which is about your five cultural artefacts and so on. And I just said, stop. I didn't understand a word you said.
Yeah,
my brain is dead now.
Yeah,
please just do one thing at a time. I couldn't think.
It's what I like about podcasts is like every time I didn't do any press junkets or press runs.
Yes,
and then I started to do them, and I realised that people quite enjoy having a long time
to
kind of break into it and not be like, oh, I've got 10 minutes. I need to get the release date in October 20th. Death of Stalin in cinema and all this kind of thing. It's like, you get that.
Yeah, and when you're talking to people and doing sort of 7 minutes with each one of them, you start to forget. When you start a story or an anecdote, you think, hang on a minute, I think I've just already told you.
Yeah.
Am I mad? Completely. Do you think I'm completely demented now?
In 7 minutes, he told the same story three times and then got up and left.
I just start, like in The Shining, just say the same anecdote. Just like for days on end.
Yeah, exactly. It was a nice turnover, a nice quick project, essentially.
Yes. And I said, yes, I'd love to do it. I was doing Veep at the time, but I said, look, as soon as I finish Veep, I'd love to do it. And I knew season 4 of Veep, I wanted to make that my last season. So as soon as it was done, I said, okay, let's do it. And actually, it came together really quickly. We spent about 5 or 6 months on the script and going out to Moscow and doing research.
Yeah.
The money to shoot it then came together very quickly. Goldmont Amazing. Came on board, so they fully financed the whole thing.
Fantastic.
Got the cast together reasonably quickly, and then a fast shoot.
And what a cast as well. I mean, the amazing. Lineup is just... Yeah. I was excited because I saw the poster, and I thought, I like everyone on the poster.
Yes.
And then I saw Paddy Considine's name, and he's been a guest on the podcast. Yeah. He's a friend. I love him.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you were doing the introduction beforehand, you mentioned Paul Whitehouse. And I was like,
what?
Damn, everyone is just
Andrea
fantastic
Ricebra
in this.
And, and Simon Russell Beale, of course, as Barrier, the kind of chief.
He was the one that stole the show from me. He stole the shower from me.
He has been known to do that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's a hidden secret in Hollywood that Simon Russell Beale actually steals your shower.
He was just so engaging in what would, if there was a lead, it would be him, I felt.
Yes.
At the front. And I'd become aware of him in The Tempest early this
Absolutely,
year. And that was the first I'd heard of him. I didn't know his rich lineage.
He's an amazing stage actor.
Yeah.
He just doesn't do that many movies or television. I think because he's committed to various stage productions.
Yeah.
It's difficult to, you know, to fit in the time off, really.
Of course,
to go
it's
away
a grueling schedule, isn't it?
And the film, I suppose, is about, you know, the tussle between Beria, who's like Stalin's chief executioner, and Khrushchev, played by Steve Buscemi.
Yeah.
It's really the tussle between the two of them as to who is going to... Basically, everyone is trying to stop Beria from taking over. They're all frightened that Beria takes over.
Yeah.
And Khrushchev is beginning to realise that he might be the one who has to try and do it.
Yeah. I love the kind of... It felt like it's a load of people who work in an office and are bitchy with each other and hate each other and trying to get one over, which is... It's funny in the moment, and then you realise that's probably what those things are like, because they are loads
absolutely.
Of people who just work together, albeit work together through the death camps and dictatorships, but it does still become a job, as
weird
as
that is. It's like office politics, and yet the decisions they make have enormous life-changing consequences for millions and millions of people. And the film doesn't shrink from that. We, you know, going into the film, I said to everyone, look, we have to be tremendously respectful of the fact that millions died or millions were imprisoned or tortured. And, you know, that's not the source of the comedy. The comedy is about what's going on inside the walls, in the ministries and in the offices, the Kremlin, the power play that's taking place. And then we see the ramifications of that outside.
Yeah, and the not shying away from that kind of allows that humour and the humanisation of it all, to come out and flow, because it's not going, ignore all the horrible bits, here's some comedy. It's going, no, it was hideous, but this is...
A film that had always made a tremendous impression on me was The Great Dictator by Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
And I went back, it'd been ages since I watched it, and I thought, just before shooting, I went back and watched it, and I thought, oh my God, I mean, it's about Hitler, and it was made in 1941, and it contains some of Chaplin's most fantastic visual comic moments, and yet it also has scenes set in the Jewish ghetto.
Yeah.
And it doesn't hide from that. It doesn't hide from the clearances and the...
Yeah, and that's the kind of exciting and horrific thing, in that there is that kind of people, like with a film like that, people... Who were involved in that will have lived through that. What's the film? Is it The Battle of Algiers? Which was made
fantastic.
Most of the cast were involved in that revolution
Absolutely.
And have been through that.
Yeah.
That's mind blowing.
And people who have seen the film who lived through that time, the Great Terror in the 30s, 40s, and 50s in the Soviet Union, they've all said, you know, we laugh throughout. It's a funny film.
Yeah.
But it is true. That's the thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, they liked the fact that it was accurate. Do you know what I mean? That we hadn't mucked about with what went on. We haven't distorted it. But they also liked the fact that it was funny. Rupert, friend in America, he went to a screening and he brought a friend of his whose father had been to the gulags. And he said the same. He said, I laughed throughout, but I can assure you this rings true.
This is good. So, there's two things that come to mind. I'll jump to this one.
Yeah.
The reaction has been amazing so far.
So
the reviews
far,
are wonderful. The Rotten, it's a weird thing that Rotten Tomato is now this gauge of films, but the rating on there is fantastic.
I know.
Have you heard much of the reaction from Russia? And the Soviet,
the media story has been that someone in the Communist Party in Russia has said, you know, this is a plot by the West to destabilize Russia and so on.
I love it.
But they haven't seen the film, and it is just a guy
in
a country of 200 million people. But it's turned into this big story. You know,
it becomes
an official
statement
exactly,
on behalf of.
And it's not, you know, it's like somebody from, you know, a tiny little council in somewhere in the UK had said, we hate Blade Runner, you know. and then the story around the world is Britain will ban Blade, you know, it's not that. And so we've got a Russian distributor, and, you know, in due time, the American release is next March. So I think around about then they'll, you know, put in process whatever needs to be done to get it in the cinemas. You know, And you know, the Ministry of Culture in Russia has said, well, we haven't seen the film, we're not going to comment, you know, we'll look at the film. Interestingly, when I was at the Toronto Film Festival, when it got its world premiere, I had a session with the Russian press, and each of them said how much they enjoyed the film.
Fantastic.
I mean, they all said also, thank God you didn't use fake Russian accents, because we hate that.
I mean, that was something I felt almost guilty of, because... The script is amazing. The performances are flawless. Yet, I was just endlessly entertained by the actors or British and American accents.
Yeah.
So Stalin had a Cockney accent, and there was Northern accents, and obviously Buscemi.
We've got a bit of Irish. We've got Scottish. Brezhnev at the end is Scottish.
It was just endlessly hilarious.
But I mean, the idea of that is to keep it. You know, if you sit and watch everyone talking like that, you know.
Yeah.
First, it'd be really slow and ponderous.
Yeah.
It doesn't free the actors up. But also, well, which Russian accent are you going to use?
Yeah.
Because, you know, the Soviet Union at the time was a massive empire.
Right, of course.
And Stalin was Georgian and Beria were Georgian. So they spoke a completely different language, you know, if they wanted to.
Yeah.
Khrushchev was from Ukraine. There were people from Belarus. There were people from the Asian side of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So you've got a whole melting pot of dialects and accents and languages there.
Yeah.
So I thought the way to replicate that was to do it in English, but to have various versions of English being spoken.
Yeah.
So you've got this mix. And also they have a mix of backgrounds. Some of them were from a sort of an intellectual, you know, previously determined bourgeois background. Others were from, you know, from peasant stock, you know, and all that. So you want this mix of and then casting wise, there's a mix of acting traditions, you know. There's Paul Whitehouse, who does his own TV stuff.
Yeah.
Michael Palin, obviously, who has that rich heritage of comedy. And then Steve Buscemi, who's got a great film back catalogue.
Yeah.
Simon Russell Beale, who's a stage actor. You know, it's all this mix that I kind of actually like.
To bring that actually into it, if anything, it would be arguable that everyone trying to put on a good Russian accent could distract from the actual performances in the person.
Absolutely.
The tradition of masks in Japanese cinema was to remove the actor or the performance almost, and just make it this, that they're a model being used to tell a story as such, which that kind of comes in there in that way, that it is, it's that kind of going, well, it's not about who can do the best accent and who can be the most authentic, it's about the mood and the tone and everything else, so let's focus on that.
And also, we're terribly literal in movies, I think. You know, if you go to the theatre, well, to start with, it's just people on a stage, and then they have to make do with what resources they have to turn it into a church hall or a moving train, or and you buy into it.
Yeah.
You buy into the fact that, you know, it might be a sort of multi-ethnic cast, but they're all playing husbands and wives and brothers, and, you know, you buy into it. You're not going, well, you know, he doesn't look like he's in the same, you know, ethnic background as him, and you know, you just you buy the suspension of disbelief, you know. You are forced to project the illusion, because the reality there is so obviously artificial.
Yeah.
And yet in movies we have to be very literal for some reason.
We seem to do so much to make it so real,
yes,
so literal. And I mean, Bresson's a great example of declining, yeah, that, of going, yes, no, cinema is its own art form. It's,
yes,
not meant to replicate real, no, life.
Exactly.
Real life is real life. You've, yes, got that every day. Cinema,
yes,
should be doing it. It shouldn't live to the restrictions of real life. It shouldn't accept,
yes,
all of these things. It shouldn't, equally, that theatre is its own thing.
Yes.
We shouldn't just be putting a camera in front of a play, essentially. There should be, you should be looking at what you can do with the medium,
yeah,
within,
I mean,
which you're working.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting,
right?
Some of the last one tried to do it in things. Was it Dogville? The one where it was,
yes,
just, again, he almost shot it like it was in a theatre.
Yeah, yeah,
know,
yeah,
just,
yeah,
very,
yeah,
minimal,
yeah,
sets,
yeah,
and
course,
so on. And it'd be interesting to see, like, a sci-fi movie where there are no special effects.
Yeah.
And it's just,
yeah,
you know, people, you know, waving, kind of making shadows on the wall to symbolize a planet,
yeah,
or something. You know,
completely.
It'd be interesting to do that. You get those on sort of, people are forced to do it in low-budget movies. You know,
yeah,
Derek Jarman and you know, Peter Greenaway, I suppose, does,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
as well.
Of course.
You know, where he says, no, it doesn't have to be a kind of, we don't have to spend billions trying to recreate this, you know, medieval city.
Yeah.
What we can do is just get some people in the right costume, and then just by the lighting and some shapes, we can make the illusion of it come alive.
Completely. And it's that thing of, as technology progresses, the more we can do, you forget that the mind can do a lot,
yeah,
as well.
But, yeah,
we don't have to replace that. We can, and we,
yes,
can choose to, but we,
yes,
can also go, well, no, you've got to deal with this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Literature is all in your head, so you could allow some of that to come,
yeah,
in, rather,
yeah,
than,
yeah,
go, this is a complete replacement for you,
yes,
having to think at all.
Absolutely.
But you should be able to go and think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I have to say, it was wonderfully relaxing to watch a piece of yours without the impending fear of viewing the dark future that is ahead.
Right, okay.
So how was it to use source material from history,
yes,
rather than, I mean, with, from the day to day to Partridge with a Richard Madeley striving to become that role now more and more, to the thick of it, and Veep just seeming to foreshadow,
right,
the,
yeah,
ludicrousy,
yeah,
of the way the world,
yeah,
is spiralling. How was it to kind of go, let's go and look at stuff that's already happened?
Well,
so we're,
yes,
not having to worry about what we're predicting,
there,
or
there was
we'll
an element of that, but you know, it was a conscious decision to, because I had been looking at the idea of dictatorships and,
yeah,
authority figures with,
yeah,
a view to maybe doing a fictional, you know, imagine there was a British,
yeah,
dictator now or something,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the story was suggested to me, and I read it and I thought, well, this is it. This is the story, because actually, why do a made-up version when I can go, this happened?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's sort of become a warning about what might be happening now in terms,
yeah,
of, you know, we shot it last summer. So it was before Trump became president. It was before his obsession with Putin,
mm-hmm,
and North Korea and other,
right,
dictators, you know. But there are certain parallels there.
I love how it feels like there's nods to numerous bits of those in it, even though it was filmed beforehand.
Exactly.
Kind of...
But, you know, where Stalin, you know, if you opposed Stalin, you would be labelled an enemy of the people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you oppose Trump, you're labelled as unpatriotic and fake news. You know,
yeah,
it's that kind of trying to shut down opposition by almost criminalising it.
Yeah,
that,
yeah,
is,
yeah,
a frightening,
yeah,
for me, it's a frightening process to see happening.
Yeah, and it all gradually, yeah, just going backwards towards that.
Yes.
With the exact same methods, under the guise of threat, under the guise of protecting ourselves, under,
yes,
the guise of it being for our own good.
Yes.
Restricting our rights and our freedoms by going, well, you don't want this, it's dangerous to you. So that's
also the,
right,
you know, the Trump very much models himself on that thing of, you know, the one person who can save the country.
Yeah.
The one person who has all the answers, and,
yeah,
no one else has. And if anyone else suggests an answer, they're an idiot, or they're,
yeah,
failing, or as I say, they're fake news. You know, they're criticised, they're,
yeah,
lambasted,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
they're, you know, they're crooked, they're, you know, tiny.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is that he can call them.
Yeah. All of the
He's
insults.
The only guy who's got the special magic to turn this,
yeah,
around, you know. So it becomes a personality cult,
yeah,
which is what Stalin became. A lot of people were carrying out these things on Stanton's behest, because, you know, he was the great leader.
Yeah.
Almost, he didn't even have to tell them to do it in a way, you know, because he just knew that that's what they would think that he would want. So they would carry
that,
it out.
That unwavering loyalty in that respect. Yes. It's fascinating because with Trump being the extreme example, but society in general having that example now, if we do seem, particularly through social media, we do seem to be turning to a world of inflexibility in debate.
I know, we don't.
You're either agree with me or you're my enemy.
Exactly.
You know, rather than you agree or we disagree, it's you agree or you're evil. And it's
and I think it's because in social media we're encouraged, you know, without being aware of it, to just talk to people who we agree with and who share our opinions or our likes, you know.
Yeah.
And if somebody disagrees with us, you just block them, you unfollow them. Your news is filtered through your own set of predetermined interests.
Yeah.
So you will only read about things that you want to read about. So you won't get something that you don't want to read about. And therefore, we kind of lose the habit. We get out of the habit of having a debate.
Yeah.
You know, so it turns into, well, you've just disagreed with me, therefore you are wrong. And because you are wrong, you are now represent a danger. I don't feel safe in your presence, so can you leave, please?
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of...
Yeah.
And we see it in politics. I mean, the Brexit thing, I think, is that thing of every party leader has decided they are the only person who can do Brexit.
Yeah, yeah.
So they won't discuss any kind of compromise with any other party.
And that's not what democracy is. And that's not what a democracy is meant to be.
It's the, you know, the definition.
That's what a dictatorship is meant to be. You're like, we've got our way, you've got your way.
Yeah.
The point of a democracy is that everyone's involved.
Everyone has their say.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea is you work towards something that represents the views of the majority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if you're saying, no, just the way the electoral system works, I'm now in charge, even though I only got whatever it was, 42% of the vote.
Yeah.
I still get to decide 100% of what's going on.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Do you think that the access to the opinion of others is restricting people from forming their own opinions properly, and that makes them defensive as well, because they've got something they're outraged about.
Yeah.
They don't really know why they've been told they should be outraged. So when that is challenged, there's a, no, you're a racist. Partly a defense mechanism of, well, I just read that I should be angry about this. And you challenged
me on also
it,
there's a sort of,
come on down.
There's a sort of pressure put upon you to join in with the outrage.
If
you haven't retweeted this, if you haven't signed this petition, you know, why not?
I did a post, yesterday on social media, just highlighting, again, not giving any comment initially even, but just highlighting that the two biggest stories of recent weeks on social media have been the appropriate outrage at Harvey Weinstein and all of his behaviour and action and his restriction of opportunity in exchange for sexual encounters and so on and so forth. And the other big story was the mourning of the legend that is Hugh Hefner.
Yes.
And the irony in that, and I'm not saying they're exactly the same or on the same level, but there's parallels of the way they've run the things. Yet,
that's hilarious.
No one said be outraged at Hugh Hefner. They said, oh, well, what a legend.
Yeah,
but then they said, be outraged at Harvey. They're like, again, they're right to be outraged at Harvey, but it's that weird thing that's...
So did you get any kind of, how dare you kind of...
I had a few people saying...
Completely 100% talking about Harvey Weinstein.
Well, that's it. I had a few people saying, so, oh, are you saying that Hugh Hefner's a rapist? I'm saying, well, he had one or two accusations.
Yeah,
but, you know, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying anything. I'm making this parallel. A really interesting one was someone just brought up another news story, because it had been suggested that hurricanes should... Or what the person said was that a study had come out saying that hurricanes having female names was making people less scared or aware of the ferocity than the ones that have male names because of a bias. So this person was saying that the hurricanes should have male names to show their power. Obviously, there was a backlash to that comment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then one person then posted the actual study, and the study said that they shouldn't be personalised at all. They shouldn't have names. They should have the warnings. And I
just be called Hurricane... Fucker. Or something.
Yeah. And I was like, I had to step away from it because the meta-ness of someone reading a headline but not the actual study.
No, I know.
And then
I
the
know,
study I know, I is know. About people judging from the name of a hurricane rather than the clear warnings that come after every hurricane.
Yeah,
and
going, yeah.
The warnings are big, but it's yeah. called Sarah.
I know.
And Sarah sounds a lovely.
Mind you, Harvey. Like, Harvey is yeah. hardly frightening as no, a name, but exactly. that was cataclysmic for a yeah. lot of people. But the other, I remember reading a story, it was just last week actually, and it was about a freshers' fair in, he was in an Oxford college, and they decided, you know how all the student societies set up their stalls?
Yeah.
But they told the Christian Union that they couldn't be there.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to make it a safe, secular space.
Yeah.
And I just think, there's so many questions being begged there about, first of all, the assumption. The values you have to put on it as an absolute,
yeah.
no question, is secularism as opposed to any hint of religion.
Yeah.
And then the kind of the lack of, and then the whole question of freedom of speech and so on comes into play.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not advocating, I'm not coming out as a Christian or, you know, yeah. evangelist, but I just struck me as kind of, that is a weird set of deciding in advance what the values are yeah. of the students who are going to yeah. come into the room.
Yeah, you know? This is against them. It's
yeah, this is against them. And also, it then takes you into the question of, like, what is wrong with being offended?
Yeah.
Just what actually is wrong? You know, if you have a set of beliefs,
100%.
If somebody challenges them, you should yeah. be able to kind of,
yeah.
you know, if you hold those beliefs, if their beliefs are held strongly,
yeah.
you should be able to withstand
yeah.
a kind of joke about them or an attack on them, verbal attack on them, 100%. Or an argument against them. You should be able to do that. If you can't, then it doesn't sound like that those beliefs are held that strongly.
No, yeah, exactly. It is a weird thing. It's another thing in modern society where we have made the mistake that offence is something that we shouldn't ever encounter. And
no.
that if we're offended, that something has to be taken off the radio or taken off no. the TV or wherever else. Like, you're allowed to be offended and you're allowed to
yeah.
react appropriately. But yeah, it doesn't yeah, mean that yeah. person has to necessarily lose their job or lose their career. They can lose yes. you as an audience.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great. That's
yeah,
often
yeah.
appropriate Absolutely. Reaction. But to yeah. have this completeness of this person has caused offence. So, well, as you said, it's good to have your beliefs challenged
yes,
every now
absolutely.
And then, right? That
absolutely.
Helps.
Yeah.
But it's. I had a journalist as Syed McKennett on recently,
yes.
who's the terrorism journalist for the Chicago Post. And one of the things that she discussed in detail was the fact that, we're allowed to have different beliefs.
Yes.
And religion is the epitome of that. It's that illusion that we have to have, well, Christians can't be friends with Muslims or whatever.
No,
no
yeah.
you're all allowed to have these different
Absolutely,
beliefs. Their belief
yeah.
systems, they shouldn't be... And equally... It's gone that other way of, right, we want no religion here. It's
like, exactly.
Well, you can have people... I was brought up a Catholic. I
yes.
don't have any religious belief, but
yes.
I'm not offended by Christianity or Catholicism
no.
or anything.
It sort of turns us all into fundamentalists
yeah.
about ourselves. You
yeah.
know what I mean? That my views
yeah.
are the only ones that I want to hear from anyone else.
In my presence at any point.
Yes.
Only my views, please.
Exactly.
That's crazy,
in fact,
right?
how dare you not be me?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm offended by the
yeah.
fact that you're not exactly like me.
And again,
you know?
it's mind-blowing to me. I realised a while back that I'm getting to a point in my life where I've got a decent idea what's right for me
yes.
and what my beliefs are. But the arrogance to think that they should be the same for
yeah.
a single mum
exactly.
in Wales
exactly.
and
exactly.
a family of
yeah.
of 10 in Ireland. Is
yeah.
Why would we have the
yeah.
same beliefs
and
the
that,
same system? We've got completely different existences.
And I think that is part of the problem with politics at the moment is, like, you know, when they do, say, reform of the benefit system or, you know, a tax reform and so on, they do this sort of analysis on a piece of paper which says, oh, well, this might work.
Yeah.
And then don't see that you can't apply this one model to everyone. You know, different people have different circumstances.
Yeah.
And in fact,
and the lack of flexibility.
Different parts of the country have wholly, completely different, you know, economies, the way the economies work and so
yeah.
on. And it's that sort of one idea fits all.
Yeah.
Which just is, I think, it leads to the frustration that people get. Oh, that sense that politicians aren't listening to them.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
completely.
That kind of politicians can have great intentions.
Yeah.
It's just the manner. It's a lack of imagination. I think that's what it is. It's
yeah.
a lack of seeing that you know, people outside their own frame of reference and outside their, you know, team of specialist advice that they get can have a different, you know, have different experiences.
Yeah, yeah. So do you find the varying pool of humanity plentiful inspiration for characters and stuff like that? Because just going back to even starting at the day-to-day and stuff like that, so much that, again, it's kind of, it's I look at the news today and see the day-to-day and things like that, and brass eye and everything. Yes. But you can also go, well, that's just people that have always existed.
Yes,
that's,
absolutely. It's putting the spot,
it's documenting them.
Well, the next film I'm going to do is David Copperfield. I'm a huge Dickens fan. You know, if you read Dickens, you know, he kind of nails it in terms of how society works. And, you know, we have this stereotype view of Dickens, which is that he wrote lots of caricatures.
Yeah.
That these are unbelievable, exaggerated people. But, you know, you read him and it's about, you know, Great Expectations is about someone who grows up, is from a poor background, is given a lot of money, becomes a snob.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in danger of losing that money, starts to realise, you know, that he's just changed his... He's twisted his whole set of values to just measure people by how rich they are.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
You know, and David Copperfield is a character, Mr. Dick, who's the first character, I think, in English literature who is acknowledged to be mentally ill.
Right.
It's a character, Mr. Dick... he's trying to write a kind of volume on something, but his thoughts, he keeps getting thoughts about the execution of Charles I his head. He just can't get it out of his head. And the only way he can get these out of his head is by writing them down on a piece of paper and sticking those bits of paper together to make a kite. And then he flies the kite. And when the kite is up in the air, all those thoughts have left his head.
Oh, wow.
And when the wind dies and the kite falls to the ground, the thoughts come back into his head. That's and it's beautiful. Just, it's marvellous,
yeah,
isn't
yeah.
it? And it's just, and Dickens, you know, and it's what we were saying, you know, these people are there, they're always there, you know, and they're not exaggerations, they're not eccentric, they're just us.
Yeah.
And, you know, we are varied and we are all unusual in our own way.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what he was picking up on.
And it's kind of the not, again, similar with the not shying away from the horror in Death of Stalin, it's the not shying away from the annoyances and the inadequacies of humans that finds their humour, I guess.
Yes.
That finds that goes, well, look how ridiculous we are. Mm. Look how ludicrous we are as people. That's funny. Let's laugh at it, because otherwise
fallible.
It's very depressing.
We're all fallible and we're all frightened of being found out. We all think we've just about got away with it. But one day someone's going to say, no, well, you shouldn't really be here. I don't know what you're doing here.
Yeah.
You know, you need to go now. It's so funny when we did In the Loop, and we were very lucky that the script got an Oscar nomination.
Yeah.
And the four of us, it's so British, you know, you're invited to an Oscars lunch.
Right.
Which is all the nominees.
Yeah.
2 weeks before the ceremony. And so we arrived and it was all the, you know, models of the Oscars. And we were kind of wandering around and we went up to the stage. You know, we were the first to arrive. We can't do that fashionably late stuff.
Yeah.
We're so excited. We're taking photos of standing next to big, tall Oscar. But there was this paranoia that someone was going to come up and say, what the hell are you doing here?
Yeah.
Get out.
Yeah.
You know, there's just that fear of, like, we shouldn't really be here, you know. This is really, only George Clooney should be here.
Yeah.
Not us, you know. And it's so kind of...
It's bizarre, isn't it? The allure and glamour of the of the American end of the film industry. Because, even at that point, you'd been on the top of the UK TV and all that for many years. But there will always still be
always something else.
Oh, I'm in the proper film industry now.
Here's a good line for you. I once had lunch with Radiohead.
Amazing. Damn right.
No. It was the Ivan Novello Awards. You know. So and they were getting up. And I said to Johnny I said, do you regard yourself as, you know, rock stars? And he said, no, we were at a thing and you two were there and we just thought, it must be great to be them.
Yeah.
You know?
There's always
they're true rock stars, aren't they? There's always someone else, isn't there?
I started off in music and the first song that I did was a song called Thou Shalt Always Kill, and it had a big bit that listed band names and then said just a band, and it got people a bit angry at the time because it was like as if it was an insult. But that came from I sat down at Christmas one year and thought of Radiohead and thought Radiohead or Radiohead, but right now they're each at their mum's houses, sat around the table being told to pass some potatoes. It's like they're just bad, all of them, everyone in film, in music.
I remember someone telling me that when we were researching for Veep, someone telling me that Henry Kissinger, when he started working in the White House under Nixon, would spend about the first year or so just saying to people, am I doing okay? Do you think he likes me? I don't know. He doesn't say. Am I all right? Am I doing all right? You just say, that's it. Henry Kissinger.
I love it.
We're just all like that.
So when you were working on In the Loop and The Thick of It, did it kind of feel like that was... I remember when watching it felt like, oh, this is perfect. This is a golden period where British politics is just... bananas, and this is perfect time to observe it, but it'll end and then we'll go back to normality. And then the show ended and the normality never came back. It feels like, and again, like all good series, it's good to go out at the right point, but it feels like that could have just kept going on and on because there's so much source material in the mess that
it's now beyond politics, you know Theresa May does a speech and the letters fall off behind her. We would have cut that as just too unbelievable, too stupid.
I was going to say, is it hard to write satire in the current political world where the satire is almost, as you said, you wouldn't, you'd edit that. You'd go, no, that's too crazy.
No, I mean, actually, you know, I'm glad that we're not doing The Thick of It because, you know, a kind of fictionalised version of what's going on, I think, doesn't carry any weight because it will feel lesser than what's going on. What's interesting is that the comedians, I think, who are sort of hitting hardest are the ones who are almost like journalists, you know, John Oliver and Samantha Bee, The Daily Show, Charlie Brooker when he's doing Newsmax. You know, what they're doing is going, okay, you know, you're telling us that the media is fake news. Why don't we, the comedians, now just sit down with a team of proper researchers and proper investigators and sift through the facts? Yeah. Hey, here's a fact. Oh, and here's something you said 4 years ago. And here's how you've changed that to this, you know, actually laying the facts out. And the comedy arises from, you know, this sequence of facts that they present to you.
Completely. And John Oliver is a perfect example of that, of just the crispness and the fact that it's getting as much response off politicians all around the world as any news reports are or anything like that. His satire digs, and I love it. I like to watch John Oliver and check on a website called fullfact.org, and they just fact check all press conferences and things like that, and just go, here's what's inaccurate. So that's the facts without the smile and entertainment, and John then turns up and goes, look at how ridiculous the world is at the moment. So how was it going from British politics to doing a Veep? Again, probably a scary jump into America, but one that ended up being hugely well-received.
Well, yes, I mean, it didn't feel scary. I mean, we'd done it a little bit within The Loop.
Of course.
But with Veep, you know, speaking to HBO, they were a little bit like working with the BBC maybe 10, 15 years ago, where they just kind of approached you and let you get on with it.
Wow.
And the first thing they said to me was, look, we like what you do, so the last thing we're going to do is say, can you change what you do?
Oh, wow. That's exactly what you want, how you want to work,
And we're here just to support you and make sure it happens and give you the resources you need and whatever. And then we'll, you know, put our whole machine behind it and, you know, when we launch it. So it didn't feel scary. It, in terms of the methodology, it was with the Thick of It writers and the same directors, and we edit all the post production was done in London.
Right.
It was really, we were out, and the cast came over to London to rehearse for 2 weeks. So we were out there in Baltimore for 4 months in the year, and the rest of the time we were over here. And yeah, there was an element of, you know, when you first make it, what will America think? You know, will they think, what are these Brits doing coming over telling us what's funny and what isn't funny?
Yeah.
And in fact, they were tremendously receptive, and a lot of them said, because you forget how polarised politics is there, how partisan it is. You know, you grew up in a Democrat house or a Republican house or a state. Or, you know, it's... And they said it maybe needed someone who wasn't part of that.
Yeah.
That kind of great divide to be able to stand back and look at the whole thing and go, okay, this is a bit bonkers. This is what we think is bonkers about it, and so on. But the other thing it made me realise, and I think this is still true despite what Trump, the image Trump projects, is America's a very welcoming country.
Yep.
You know, that's its success story is built on people coming from anywhere and everywhere.
On the American dream.
And just, you know, the melting pot thing of just everyone come in.
Yeah.
And, you know, so nobody had a problem with the fact that we weren't from America.
Yeah.
And I keep thinking, what would it be like if the French came here and did a satire on British politics? How would we take that? Or the Americans came here and did.
Yeah, yeah.
We'd be a little bit kind of, what are you doing?
We would be so British about it.
I know.
But yeah.
And yet, so it was a useful, you know, I do find them a generous people and a receptive and, you know, so, and I think that still is the case despite, you know, the profile Trump has given to this other aspect, this kind of isolationist, nationalistic side.
Yeah, it is a fascinating one. And you're right that it may have been hard for any American to write unbiased on these subjects. Because, yes. I mean, even I've got friends who are so, you know, a very aware and aware of the damage that Trump is doing and things like that, but then they're still deep down, I mean, we're still America. It's still America the Great, America number one kind of thing. And that's still there, no matter how ashamed they are or how questioning they are, it's still, but I still love, it's still the beautiful America and all that kind of thing. It's like, well, yeah, you can't be objective.
And also, you know, you forget how much it is to do with just the land. You know, it's a vast... vast country, and there's a relationship with the state that we don't have. You know, maybe Yorkshire has a kind of thing about being from Yorkshire and so on, but we're not as wedded to the region
completely.
Much as in America. The state is as important as as the bigger country.
And I mean, again, it wasn't until I toured America that you can't. I mean, as a Brit, you're always going, oh. You know, that it's what's the crazy statistic? Something like 60% or 70% of Americans haven't
got a passport.
Yeah. It's like, and then you go there and you go, oh, right, it's because they've got multiple countries in one country.
Exactly.
We live on a small island. Exactly. We need a fucking passport to experience anything. Whereas,
you know, they've got every climate there. And, you know, they've got the desert, they've got the snow, they've got, you know, the mountains, they've got, you know, the beaches. So you can see why. I mean, it is massive.
Yeah.
And the other thing we forget is it's a foreign country.
Yeah.
It's not Britain.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they speak English. It's that Alistair Cook thing of America and Britain are divided by the same language. You know?
Yeah, yeah,
we
think
we're the same and we're not. It's different sets of cultural values, which is why we just don't get this... the guns thing, or the, you know, healthcare is an infringement on your personal freedom.
Yeah.
Which is all part of this, you know, anti-government. It's all, you know, Americans came there to be free from, you know, the Brits and the tax, you know.
Yep.
So it's part of that, you know, it's in the DNA that sort of, we don't want any kind of anyone else telling us what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that we can't, I'm not justifying the gun thing. It's bizarre.
But
you forget that it is another country.
Yeah, yeah. It's the root of the gun thing is, and again, I can't defend it because it's a faulted argument, but it's to be able to protect yourself against the government, to protect yourself against other things, to have that independence as individuals.
Yes.
It's a bizarre one, but it's because that's not how we've grown up or existed.
I know.
Well, I'll start to wrap things up. I want to know, before we end, on the kind of directing front, how was it to work with all of these characters, particularly when they are... putting so much of themselves into each role. Was there a lot more of your time and focus spent in getting the script right? And then when you're there, kind of going, well you're Steve Buscemi.
Yeah.
So do what you know how to do
There's an overlap because, you know, a lot of work goes in the script. But actually, while we're doing that work, I like to cast early. Because we like to know who it is we're writing for.
Fantastic.
You know,
I was going to say, did the accents were they on paper before were cast?
It was like who's going to
work
this part.
And then
talking to the actor about that person, and they did a bit of research, and we supplied a bit of research, and You know, Steve looked at Khrushchev's sort of physical mannerisms, his use of his hands and gestures, which is slightly Italian in a way, slightly kind of Latin, kind of being very emphatic with your hand gestures and so on. Or Andrea, you know, we talked very early on about what Svetlana would be like. She read biographies and the autobiography in her letters, and just to get the kind of nervous fragility about. So we, you know, we worked on that and fed that into the script. And then as a cast, they all met ahead of the filming for a couple of weeks to rehearse. And that's when they got to know each other's characters as well as their own and develop those relationships.
And that's what came across brilliantly. So that when you go into the shoot,
exactly. So that when you go into the shoot, you're not having those conversations that take up an hour and a half and everyone, 150 people on set, are standing around waiting for the first take. You've had those discussions.
Yeah.
And now let's do it. And there's still time to play around, but it means everyone is confident about who they are and who everyone else is and what to do. So the writing actually sort of merges imperceptibly into the directing and performing
side. Right, that's great. So so I'll let you get on now, but how much time have you got to focus on this release and the excitement? Are you straight into David Copperfield?
No, you know, we'll do another couple of weeks of this, and then, you know, it all starts again in America next year.
We'll have to do that. Yeah,
you know, hopefully by then we'll have finished casting Copperfield, and I'll be thinking about that. But you know, it's what people do. You know, I knew after Veep I wanted to start making more movies. It had been 9 years since In the Loop, and talking to other directors, they all said you've got to have 3 or 4 projects on the go. Because the way it works is, you know, you may be ready to shoot one and then it all falls apart, or you have to delay it because, you know, the cast that you want just aren't available for another year.
There's so many
and then you
parts.
Move to the next one. If that happens, then pull the next one out and get going with that one. So that's where I'm doing. Yeah. I've got about 3 or 4 projects.
It's the difference of TV, stages. Isn't it? On TV, it's kind of your... People are locked in for that period.
Exactly.
And they're locked.
And
they're
you kind of know everything. You know how many episodes, you know how long they have to be, you know what the budget is, you know when it's going out. Film, it's such a crazy business model. It's, well, here's the idea. I don't know if we're going to get anyone to pay for us to write it. Yeah. Oh, we have. There we go. Now let's see if someone will pay for us to make it. Oh, they've given us money. Oh, great. Who will be in it? Well, let's work that out. Okay, great. We've made the film now. Does anyone want to show it?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Now we've got someone to pay for that. And, you know, and you just think, this is crazy.
It's the things that you completely can't plan for well. The favours that people owe and whatever. Oh, well, if you keep him for this bit longer, we can keep him. So we'll push this film back here.
Absolutely.
Because you need that actor over
it's
there.
It's a massive three-dimensional chess game that goes on.
Which makes sense, as said then, to have multiple things on the go so you don't lay in bed pulling your hair out going, so when are they? So when do we start? When does this happen? It's okay, let's just allow it to be what it is. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for taking the time. It's been a pleasure chatting. Yeah. Cheers.
Wow, thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Armando Iannucci. What an absolute legend. Amazing to get to sit down with the dude. I've been a fan of him for a long time, so I was really appreciative of him making the time. As I mentioned earlier, next week's guest, another great writer and director, S. Craig Zahler. You're going to enjoy that. He's a maverick. That's the best. The best way to describe him. The gentleman is a maverick. So check that out next week. Also subscribe and rate and review if you're the kind of sad loser that subscribes and rates and reviews podcasts. I mean, just get on with your life. Don't rate me. How dare, who do you think you, only God can judge me. And I don't believe in him. So no one can judge me. So don't rate and review. There's no need for that. Let's all be grown-ups about this. Enjoy the free content. Maybe have a look at speechofanimalrecords.com to spend some money. Other than that, just get on with your day, dude. It is all good. Enjoy yourselves. Right. I'm going to go. So next week is S. Craig Zahler. The week after that, I'm going to finally put out the live Distraction Pieces podcast from Dublin that a lot of you have been waiting for a long time. Then after that, I'm going to put out the Jean Grey episode. Then after that, I'm going to put out the Johnny Lee Miller episode. I've got a lot of episodes to put out. I'm a busy man. I've got a lot recorded. They're all treats for you guys, and you're going to love them all. So yeah, enjoy that, and I will see you. I'll see you next week. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.